Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Boy, I love your background.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, from left to right. Will you see the EAT license plate?
I do.
That used to be
Yes.
the license plate for my food tour company, Hawaii Food Tours, for many years.
Oh my gosh,
And
that's great.
then of course we have the Yankees gnome sitting right in front of that. And a little menorah next to in front of him because he's a Jewish Yankee gnome. And then right behind me, kind of a French boulangerie. And then the next picture, painting of the wine and the cheese, my wife Lynn painted. And then below that is a copper wrapped lined champagne bottle. So that's what you're looking at in my background. It's basically to deflect away from me and to have people just, oh, how cool. It's like a gallery.
Is so cool. I think it's the greatest background I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you. That's really, really nice. I'm so glad you were able to join me today.
Thank you. Me too. What a treat.
You know, I listened to one of your shows recently with a gentleman who talked about podcasting.
Oh, was that Colin Gray? Maybe
I think
the
it was
English
Colin.
guy?
Yeah, I think it was Colin Gray. Right. And he was giving you some tips, and you were talking about the trials and tribulations of doing all the editing and all the things that are necessary to make this happen.
Can you relate?
I can relate, absolutely. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. Happy to talk about anything.
Oh yeah, so we can get to that a little bit later, but I always do start the show, each and every show, by asking my guests, what have you eaten today?
Oh, it's maybe not that interesting. I've eaten oatmeal with blueberries.
That's it, huh?
That's
You didn't do your research. You know, you're supposed to elaborate and get into the whole fancy schmancy part of Elizabeth's world as far as what she eats.
It's a little bit, I mean, it's maybe a little bit elaborate. I toasted pecans.
Ooh.
I like to do things kind of a little bit my own way. Toasted pecans, almond milk. So I don't know. It's a little bit my own spin on it, I guess. But I love blueberries. I eat blueberries every day. So whether, fresh or frozen when they're not in season, but I always have to get blueberries into something.
Some
So
people really dig the blueberries.
I am a blueberry digger, that is for sure. In the summer, I'm so happy in August. It's blueberry season. And in the winter, I will eat frozen blueberries that are, organic blueberries that have been fresh frozen. So,
Have you ever seen the wild blueberries that are really, really tiny?
yes,
What
those
do
are
you think?
delicious.
What do you think of those compared to the traditional standard blueberry?
I prefer a traditional standard blueberry just because I like the bite, the crunch, but I will take a blueberry however I can get it.
You know, last week I was shopping at a Sprouts market and I
Oh
saw
yeah.
blueberries the size of a grape. I've never seen them that large before. Have you seen those yet?
I've seen them and I've actually eaten them, and they were a little odd to me just because they were so big. I mean,
Were they
they just didn't,
soft?
they were a little crunchy. They were a little more grape-like, the ones I had.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that either.
No, I don't like these foods that seem almost a little genetically modified to be something they're not supposed to be. And that's actually why I eat frozen blueberries in the winter, because I like to eat foods in season. So I'm not going to eat, foods. I try not to eat foods that are flown like all across the world that, out of season. I'd rather eat something that's frozen when it was fresh, and then foods that are fresh in the season. So,
Right. You mentioned GMO before. Do you realize that just so many products are genetically modified nowadays?
oh yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you real
Can't.
foodie? Are you up on all of that's going on as far as locally sourced and organic and all that?
I mean, barely, and not as much as some people are, but pretty much. I mean, recently, actually, one of my daughters, I have 16 and 14-year-old daughters,
Oh
and my
gosh, for a
older
second, I
daughter.
thought you were going to say you had 16 children. I'm like, oh my God.
I have a friend who has eight children.
Wow.
She's halfway there, but no, I have two children, two teenagers, and my older daughter, a couple months ago, said she wanted to become vegan just overnight.
Wow.
And we weren't even vegetarian. I mean, we definitely skew towards plant-based, but nothing that strict. So all of a sudden, overnight, she and I went vegan because I thought, well, I'm cooking for her vegan. I might as well do it too. I'm not going to cook for one vegan. Yeah. So it was all of a sudden just full in. I mean, it was hard to just suddenly be like, okay, I'm buying nutritional yeast and, you know, the plant-based eggs and just it was really a big change. So I had to educate myself a lot on, you know, flax eggs and everything because I bake a lot. And so vegan baking. So we've kind of eased off. I followed her lead because I thought I'll do this as long as you want. And after a while it was too tough for her because she's a really competitive basketball player and she couldn't really do it with her team to when she travels and everything. So she's more kind of vegetarian now, and but we still do a lot. We still do a lot of plant-based food.
It sounds like in a way that she had a momentary lapse and then she kind of came back to her senses because a plate of bacon and eggs is not possible if you're going vegan.
No, and she does like her eggs. So but it is interesting. You know, it's good to just kind of, you know, educate yourself a little bit about what's going on and why. Like, why are you eating what you're eating? What's really in your food? What is real food anyway? Like it's good for kids, I think, as they're growing up to really think about what am I eating? What are other people eating? What do I really like? How does my body feel when I'm eating different foods?
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting kind of journey.
I think it's really interesting when people want to go vegan or vegetarian because it's mostly driven by ethical and moral values, more so than a reality or a knowledge base of health and metabolic. And so it's just very interesting to see when someone says they eat healthy. I think that whole eating healthy terminology is very mixed up, especially here in the United States where everyone is plugged into the SAD diet, the standard American diet, which in no way is even close to eating healthy. And so it's always interesting to speak to people about that, and it gives me some sort of an understanding of where they are in their life based on that very first question that we begin the show with, like, what have you eaten today? It tells me a lot about the people.
It is such a good point, because actually very shortly into this vegan experiment, I went out to dinner with a couple of friends of mine, and I had said, oh, my Catherine and I are trying out veganism. And one of my friends who's English said, oh, wow, that is interesting. One of my thoughts or my issues with veganism is so many of the vegan foods I see are very processed. And I thought, yeah, wow, that because you oftentimes people associate like, oh, vegan must be so healthy. But here in America, of course, you can be very healthy and eat vegan. But also so many products now have been made to serve the vegan community, you know, these sort of meats or what are all these cheeses and all these things to be vegan, or you can just eat really sugary, floury things that are still vegan. And anyway, it's just sort of interesting because to see what is, I've never heard that SAD, standard American diet, but you can eat really unhealthy under a healthy label still. And so you really need to think about kind of what you're eating and what are the ingredients of things that you're eating.
Oh yeah, there's just so much BS in the marketplace related to vegan and vegetarian and the highly processed nature of most of the foods that are available to us. And I mean, it's no wonder when you have companies or organizations like the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association on the take, they're willing to, for a few bucks, put their stamp of approval on your Honey Nut Cheerios and tell you it's good for your heart. It's like, what are we supposed to do? You know, when the organizations like that you're brought up to trust are giving you this kind of information that you cannot rely upon.
That's right. Was it in the 80s or the 90s? There's that whole craze about oats, you know, is that maybe with the Honey Nut Oats thing, but everyone was fed this line that like oats are good for your heart and everyone should eat all these oats. And then there was the low fat craze but it didn't mean anything. I mean, low fat doesn't mean anything for your health. You could just keep eating more food. It doesn't matter if it's low fat, if you're going to eat four times as much of it. So
exactly. And you know, the whole low fat dilemma was really just more BS coming at us from the big food organizations, because to make something low fat, you have to add other things in if you're skimming off the fat. Right. And oftentimes you're putting in sugar and fillers and preservatives and things like that. And of course, they have to put in their crack, their laboratory crack, because they want us to eat and then overeat. And so that was a big fail, the whole low fat craze.
I think I read somewhere many years ago that, I don't know if the best way to eat, a great way to eat is food that your grandmother or great grandmother would have recognized. Mm-hmm. And I think of that sometimes, you know, just it's sort of the Whole Foods, not the store, but the actual Whole Foods way. Like, would they have recognized, butter and milk and oats and wheat and, you know, lettuce and, you know, just basic foods put together well, not all of this stuff with preservatives and processing and that sort of thing, you know, like just real food.
Yep. Real food driven by health concerns and not by the almighty buck and boardrooms and seat members and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. The bottom line.
A nice pot roast will do you.
That's right. Yeah. And like a little moderation on all things, I think, is fine.
The American animal, which we are, wasn't meant to be eating 24 hours a day. And way back when, 100,000 years ago, people wouldn't eat until they were able to hunt down the woolly mammoth, kill it, and then they'd feast for however long that lasted. And then who knows how long they'd go without food sources again. And so we've gotten so far away from that now.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey too, just for me raising kids and having two girls, because, you know, there's so many, I think food is such an interesting issue in our culture, since of course we need it for sustenance, but it's also a form of celebration. And then it's become a guilt thing for some people, you know, people overeat or they have eating issues of using it as control, and people have, you know, undereat and all that. And so I feel like I've really tried to model for my kids of just food is a wonderful thing, and we use it as a, you know, we need it every day, and it can be a beautiful thing that we sit around and we have family dinners and all that, but it's nothing that we need to obsess over, you know, it's nothing that we need to have as a control issue. And when we're done, we're done. It's there. Luckily, we have plenty. There will always be more. You know, you don't need to hoard it. And, you know, we're very fortunate. We live in a privileged place. And so we don't need to worry and have it be an issue. And so I just think food can take a really weird place in our minds sometimes. So I'm just trying to really normalize it in our family.
Oh, that's good that you do, because remember when you were a little kid, if you misbehaved at the table or if you didn't eat everything on your plate, like mommy demanded, that she would threaten to not give you dessert, which really that was a threat. That was like major angst would be created by mommy saying that to you. But you know what? That would have been a good thing, not having so many sugary desserts when we were growing up. It would have ended up being a good thing, a positive thing.
Or there was that thing like, you better clean your plate because there are kids starving in China. That was always the thing, kids starving in China. That was the phrase when I was growing up.
That's right.
And it was like,
as if you could make up for it by finishing your plate, there would be fewer people starving in Ethiopia because I just finished my plate.
So no way. I have to eat one of the meals on the rotation when I was growing up was liver and onions.
Same here, calves, liver, and onions. And it was probably disgusting to you. You fed it to the plant.
Yeah, uh-huh. That was nothing I wanted to eat. I don't know why that was something in the 70s, but that was one of the 7 or 10 meals that was on the rotation. And I thought, this is not a finish the plate kind of meal.
But you know, it's funny because now, cut to the present, we're learning that organ meat is super healthy for us, not unhealthy like it was proposed 30 years ago.
It might have been the way it was prepared. I mean,
and my mom
has become a very good cook, but I think sometimes some food was perhaps overcooked in those early days.
Oh, yeah. Well, my mom made fish, for instance, so once or twice a month she'd make it. The whole neighborhood could smell it. It was like terrible. So, you know, we all kind of had to suffer through the wars of mom's foods, right?
Well, my mom, fortunately, when I was little, I guess she and her very good friend decided to cook their way through Julia Child's Art of French Cooking. And they every week they'd have a dinner party. I don't remember it. I was like a baby, but they'd have these dinner parties and they would sort of not compete, but cooperate, I guess, with Julia's recipe. So they decided they needed to become good cooks. I don't know why they become French, because they were inspired by Julia. So that was pretty cool. Like,
oh yeah,
around 1970 or
yeah, French food has always been considered the top of the line of the culinary arts. That's how I was schooled, you know. And so yeah, a lot of people worked their way through Julia Child's book and actually became very, very adept at being able to put together flavors and aromas and textures and things like that in the kitchen.
Yeah. So that was great. I mean, she truly did inspire a whole generation of women to up their game.
Right. Well, thank goodness for her, right? Because now food has turned into a competition. It's not an art form anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
There's more stuff related to the whole food world, right?
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So I was thinking the other day how cool of a gig your podcast is, that you speak to very interesting people. Can you give us a little bit of background on who you are and why you're doing what you're doing now?
Oh, sure. Yeah, thanks. I started out, well, I guess really early after college, I actually wanted to be a food writer, since we're talking about food. That was my first desire. And people said, well, you can't just say you want to be a food writer. You need some actual expertise in food. So I went to cooking school right out of college.
Ah, same here.
And then I did start writing about food, kind of freelance. And from that, because I had that background, I saw a little clip in a newspaper that there was this thing called the TV Food Network.
Right.
Well, then it was called the Television Food Network, starting in New York. And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. And I wrote a letter and said to some name, an exec, and said, I'm going to be in New York next week. Any chance I could meet with you? I'd love to work for your fledgling network. And I had no plans to be in New York next week. I just made myself be in New York next week. And he said, sure, I'd love to meet with you. And he offered me a job. And so I became one of the first employees of the TV Food Network. I was like the fifth employee or something. And
wow.
So there I was. I don't know. I don't know if I could say I helped get it off the ground, but I was one of the first employees. And so I worked there for like 2.5 years at something called the Food News and Views. Anyway, I could go into that, but that kind of got me into the TV world, because I had food background, but no TV background. And so the early Food Network was half food people and half who didn't know about TV, and half TV people who didn't know about food.
Right, right.
So they were like news people, people who had worked in local news. And so we were all kind of teaching each other things.
That's so cool, the whole Food Network thing, because that's something that when I heard about it, I guess it was the late 80s when it launched. And I
Early
90s, yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. I so wanted a show, because I also have the background of food education, Cordon Bleu,
yeah.
And uh-huh. I became a food writer eventually here in Honolulu.
Uh-huh.
And so you probably agree with me if I say, at some point, did writing a review start off by thinking to yourself, how am I going to get 1,000 words out of this experience? That's the way that I became after years.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't a food writer for that long. I think mm-hmm. I eventually, it was just a couple years for me. And then I had wanted to work in TV, and I kept thinking, I wonder how this, I had been really discouraged by people for a long time. It's too hard. You can't work in TV.
Right.
And then when I saw this opportunity, I thought, this is made for me. And so that's how I got my foot in the door, because I had this food background, and I was just kind of lucky there. And then they eventually canceled our show, because turns out no one really wants to watch a news show about food. They really want to watch cooking shows. And right. So they canceled our show, and they offered me another show. And I just decided I was done with living in New York, and I was ready to move. I'm a Californian originally, and I wanted to move back to California. I moved to LA, even though I'm from the Bay Area. And so I kept working in TV, eventually went to work in local news. And then I did news and production and writing and kind of a bunch of things like that. And then eventually went to graduate school in documentary film. So that's all kind of my background is like writing, communication, film. And that's, then I took a lot of time off after I got married and had kids. And then a couple of years ago, I thought, how can I, I'm finally answering your question about the podcast, but I'm happy to go back to any of that previous stuff. But a couple of years ago, I thought I'd love to do something related to all the stuff I've done before, but I'm not going to live in LA or New York again. I have kids, we have a family, a life here in the Bay Area. And so what can I do? And maybe a podcast. I can still interview people, tell stories, delve into interesting topics. So that's kind of how I got into the podcast. And so my topic is I interview people who have done really interesting, unique things that most of us will never do. So I interviewed a guy who summited Mount Everest and someone, a 16-year-old who set a world record for sailing solo across the Atlantic and someone who won an Olympic medal and it's more serious topics too. A guy who was wrongly accused of murder and imprisoned for 19 years. And so just kind of a wide gamut of things.
I think that's such a cool niche. How did you discover that that was the angle in which you wanted to approach podcasting?
Thank you for calling it a niche because some people say, what's your niche? It's too broad. I said, oh, like it needs to be nichier, I guess. That's a whole thing in podcasting, isn't it? What's your niche? And that's hard for me because I have a broad range of interests. And I think that just goes to my background kind of from journalism and filmmaking. Like I'm just super curious. I think that's, you know, being a writer and everything, like you get into it because you're a curious person. You just ask a lot of questions. You have an open mind. You want to get to know things. And so that was basically it. I just feel like I love to know behind the scenes things. I'm always the person sitting through all the credits of the film. Who did this? Where was it filmed? What happened? I always read the back of the book, you know, the flap about the author. And my husband's always like, you always want to go behind the scenes. And so that's kind of what inspired this topic for the podcast is always kind of behind the scenes. What's really happening? How did they do that? How did they do it? What went on to what inspired them to, and what I have found through all these interviews I've done, like over 60 episodes so far, is that the common theme isn't just, oh, look how great they achieved this thing. But the common kind of human thing, even those of us who, you know, I'm never going to summit Mount Everest, but they, like all of us, had ideas, goals, passions, and have come up against a lot of hardships. Like we all have hard times along the way, but these people didn't give up. You know, they kept going even when they hit those walls. And that's how he won the Olympic medal, is because we had the injuries when he fell. He got back up. And so that's what I find really inspiring because I feel like those are messages that I need to keep hearing because anything you take on, like this podcast, for example, it's not all easy. It sometimes seems like, oh, I get to just talk to people like you and my guests, and this is super fun. But a lot of the behind the scenes stuff is challenging. You know, there's hard stuff and there's a lot of times it would be easy to give up. But if you really want to do it, you have to kind of stand up again and keep going.
You're so right about that. Did you find that some of the people that you've interviewed along the way, that their personalities have sparkled, especially because they've been able to attain such amazing things? Or do you find that they're just like regular people? Some people have great social skills. Some people have great stories. The two sometimes don't meet. But have you found anything in particular about those kinds of people?
That's such an interesting question. I have found in general that these people have been really easy and fascinating to talk to. It's the vast minority that have been harder to talk to. You know, there's just been a few that I thought like, okay, I really need to try to pull something out of these people. But for the most part, I think they have, partly because they have really great stories to tell. You know, I mean, they really have, I guess I don't like how that sounds as soon as it came out of my mouth, stories to tell. It's not just a story. They really have interesting narratives. They have interesting challenges that they've overcome. So it's not like, oh, I did this and then I did that. It's not just a simple little story. It's truly challenges that they've taken on and pursued.
You know, referring back a couple of moments ago when you began telling us a story of people thinking that your niche is too broad.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case at all. I think that's like perfectly focused. And, you know, it's something that, wow, that's a great idea. That's like, it might be difficult locating guests and doing all that. But as far as the niche itself, it sounds fantastic to me.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I I'm sticking with it because it feels good to me. And I think that's kind of at the end of the day, what you have to go with, right? That's why I started this podcast, is because I thought if it's interesting to me, it's probably interesting to other people, I hope. I mean, I don't think I'm way off base, and it seems to be, but I guess the challenge seems to be with marketing. I'm not a marketing expert. I'm a journalist and a storyteller or creative person, and seems to be with marketing. If you have a specific niche, like if your podcast is about soccer, then you can say, and not just about soccer, but about soccer for 13 to 17 year olds in Argentina or something, then you can really go after that niche or something like that.
You can get a real loyal following of the five people on earth who care about that.
And apparently I'm a little too broad for that kind of niche-based marketing.
Right. Well, yeah, podcasting can definitely be a pain in the ass. Not this part of it where we're getting to talk and chat and look at each other. The hard part is the stuff, the editing and the marketing and all the things that are behind the scenes that people don't see or hear.
That's right. So, yeah, I have friends that will say like, oh gosh, it seems so fun. Like maybe I should start a podcast. And I was like, great, you can just realize it's a lot more work than it looks. It's not just listening. You don't just hit record and then it just goes out. It's a lot more work than that.
Exactly. I want to come back to the podcast stuff in a little bit, but while it's on my mind, I want to let you know that David Page, the creator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Oh, yes.
Was on with me recently. And so when you were talking about your experience at the Food Network, I was thinking, oh, maybe you know each other.
I don't, but I think that is the show that they offered for me to work on when they canceled Food News and Views, the show that I was working on, at least was a version of that. Because they offered that I could work on a show that I would be traveling constantly and going around to basically restaurants, diners, whatever, and interviewing people all over the country. And I thought, it's too much. I can't handle it. So I think that's the show that it became.
That's so funny. That just reminds me of the person who turned down the role, the starring role in the Titanic. You know, had you been able to be on that show, who knows where you'd be today in some ways, right?
That is true. And instead I was like, oh, I'm sick of living in New York. I need to change.
That's funny. So what part of the world are you in right now?
I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, we need to talk about this, Elizabeth. What the hell has become of San Francisco?
Oh, poor San Francisco. Yeah, I live south of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It's such a beautiful city. I think politically, I don't know. I'm not there very often, but there's a lot of homelessness issues and it's really changed. Yeah.
We don't like to talk about politics here on this show or religion, but when it comes to a big, beautiful city, now I'm saying beautiful in the visual way because it's no longer beautiful in the way it once was in addition to the way it looks.
Yeah.
It is a political issue that a lot of the big blue cities have been suffering so much. Can you see, do you have any special insight because of your proximity?
I mean, it's always going to be a blue city, right? So it's not like it's ever going to have it's always going to have Democratic leadership. But within that, I think how liberal or not liberal is probably going to change, because I think there's just people there's been such a mass exodus of people living there. Like rents have gone down so much since COVID. I mean, so much has happened, right? All these people aren't working in offices anymore since COVID. I think some have gone back, but there's all these vacancies of office space. And then a lot of people have just left, you know, people don't live there as much anymore. And also all this unhoused population has exploded. A lot of the drug use has exploded. Retailers are leaving, like Nordstrom left. A lot of people are leaving the downtown area because they just don't feel as safe anymore. Right. And I have a friend who has lived there for so long, and we were at this big event together, not in the city, but she was telling these stories and she looked around those of us who live like in the suburbs. She said, oh, maybe I shouldn't be saying these things. I don't want to scare you guys away from still like coming to dinner in the city or something. And we were like, yeah, but your stories aren't very good of like smash and grabs and, you know, people knock, you know, doing all this terrible things to local shops. And so, I mean, we still go, we went to a concert there recently, and you still go, but it's pretty sad.
You go with your security detail.
Yeah. Who's known as my husband, but yeah.
Right. Oh, so you were talking about your husband before when you were watching movies. You're one of those people like I who like to look at the credits and listen to the two or three or four songs that they play during the credits and read who's who and what these people have done. And he's the one who says, come on, babe, let's leave. Let's get out of here. While the credits are rolling, wait a second, I'm a different person than that.
Although he met me when I was in, or I had just finished grad school in documentary film. And so he was very well aware what he was getting into, which was a film girl. And so he was like, I said, we need to honor every single person who has worked on this film and I care about. So he gets it now. He's like, we're going to sit here and watch.
You brought him around. All you these trained people. Him.
Uh-huh. And now if you notice so many films, they put little like Easter eggs in there. They give you like extra content because they to make people stay around.
right. An outtake here and there, an Easter egg here and there. Right. That's true. And people don't realize that. The people who get up and spill their popcorn on the way out.
Yeah. Rush out to the bathroom. Like, no, we're, or go to beat the traffic. Like,
we're
no,
in it. We paid $17 for these seats.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I want to see like how many studios did they film this in?
Right. And are the locations real places or AI?
I know. Oh boy. That's another big issue, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of AI, how has that found its way into your life, whether it's broadcasting, writing, podcasting, et cetera?
You know, not very much. I've had a few people tell me like, oh, this is going to change your life. You should be using it so much. Like it could write your show notes. And I guess I'm a little bit old school. I love to write. So I just kind of keep writing. Where I have been using it I use for my editing a program called Descript. Uh-huh. And so I don't need to go into great detail. Listeners don't really care, but it immediately shoots out a transcript. So an AI transcript, it's not exactly correct, but so you can kind of do a quick edit. It's almost as easy as doing like a Word document. And so there's that, but I don't use AI to generate really content for me.
Does Descript? Although
maybe I should be.
Well, yeah, that was just going to ask you. I'm not all that familiar with Descript, but can you clone your voice and then be able to write something with, let's say, ChatGPT and go text to speech utilizing your voice trained AI to be able to create content?
Yeah, apparently you can. I haven't done it yet, though.
Wow. Neither have I, but I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. So you can. In fact, I just saw a thing yesterday or the day before. What was it? I just saw sort of a headline. I didn't click on the whole thing. I think they said you can do like a whole episode now or something where they can have you. It's blowing my mind. I mean, I thought that this content stuff that we're creating, like we're maybe going to be the last man standing because at least we're creating original content. No, now they can. No, they don't even need us anymore. They just need our voices.
That's right. And it's easy enough. Like in the flash of a moment, they can create your likeness and your voice.
I know. No wonder these actors and writers struck for so long. You know, everything they do is being outsourced or they're not needed anymore.
Yeah. How do you think that's going to affect the documentary industry or the people who work within that? Is that part of the whole actor strike and the people in SAG-AFTRA?
I don't think so. I mean, typically, I think since documentaries deal with real people, it would be separate from that. And I think there's would be enough of a movement to, I don't know. I just started talking and then I thought, I'm such an idealist. My mom was a drama teacher growing up and we had a bumper sticker on the car that said, keep arts alive, you know, during Prop 13 in California, which took funding from all the arts programs. And, you know, so I was just going to say, there'll always be enough of a movement for, you know, true art. And I don't know, maybe not, you know.
You know, I share that skeptical viewpoint. Absolutely. So when it comes to the marketing aspect of your podcast, and what is its name again?
It's called What It's Like To, every episode is, you know, what it's like to attend the Academy Awards, what it's like to create, blah, blah, you know, so I start every episode saying, this is what it's like to do this.
I love that. I think that's really solid. I think your show is really good and I enjoyed it.
Thank you. That's so nice of you.
Back in the old days when I was doing talk radio, terrestrial radio is what they call it now, where you had radio stations and people were listening now when you're speaking. I had to do incredible amounts of research. I never read more prior to the years that I was doing radio than ever since. And so everything was done in linear fashion. B always followed A, C always followed B. And I had to really know everything about everybody. Now, in this day and age, even without the use of AI, being able to do podcasting, you and I can have this lovely discussion, conversation, talk about everything in life worth loving. And then when I'm editing, I go back and I give my thoughts at the beginning as an intro, and it be able to, it kind of lays the groundwork for what people are about to hear. And I think that that's a really cool aspect of this.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it interesting? But so you were doing live radio.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and just,
are there any people, you know, under the age of 40 who even know what that is?
I mean, I look at my kids and I'm just amazed at how they approach the world and how they approach content. You know, it's all, what do I want now? And then it can come to me. They are just, it's not, it's completely 180 degrees different from how I would say their grandparents look at it. I feel like my husband and I, being sort of the middle generation, we sort of do both. You know, I could still perhaps listen to the radio and take what's being fed to me. I can see it both ways. My in-laws will just still sit in front of the TV and wait for the news to come on. You know, my kids would never, never, ever sit in front of a television and wait for a program to come on or sit. I did hear, my older daughter drives now. So she did say the other day, I was listening to the radio and I thought, really? You were rather than putting Spotify on and curating your playlist, like that seems shocking because every other time it's, what do I want to listen to? What do I want to watch? You know, it's always, it's coming at me. And it's just in the course of, you know, a generation and a half or so, it's totally changed.
You bring up a really good point. The kids of today are getting instant gratification, something that you and I always wanted when we were children. Yeah. But the instant gratification, I don't think is really solved any problems or issues. I don't think it's made people be more thoughtful. I don't think that it has really educated people in a real social way or in an educational way. So how do you split those hairs knowing the way it used to be and how hard life used to be when you used to learn things at a natural level, an organic level, and now everything is instant and everybody's got a device at the end of their arm 24/7?
I have really strong feelings about social media. I just wrote an article about this. Our kids don't have social media and it's kind of a huge deal for them. Like, oh my gosh, we're teenagers without social media. Like, I mean, we're just talking about sort of Spotify and streaming. That's one thing. And that's already a, you know, big change from how the world used to be, but then you take it to that whole next level of social media. And I just feel like that has completely changed how people interact and have, you know, skills and ability to and resilience. And one example that I told my kids in terms of why I don't want them, well, I guess we can stay off social media aside, just that idea of having a device and having that ability to just search up anything, not having to ask, think through what might that, you know, if somebody says, who won the 1950 World Series? Oh, let's have a conversation about it. Do you know? Oh, my dad used to talk about baseball all the time. Oh, my mom loves da da da. No, now it's just, let me search that up and find out who. Nobody has to sort of have conversations about issues, trivia or anything anymore. And then I said to my kids recently, you know, you're in a few short years, you're going to be in college and you're going to be in your 20s. Like these are really, really rich years full of opportunities, meeting so many new people, some of the most interesting people you're going to meet, just such diverse people are in front of you. And when you're standing in line at a dining hall, at a bookstore, at a game, at a getting into a lecture hall, are you going to be staring at a device or are you going to look up and are you going to start talking to that person in front of you or in back of you? That could be one of the most interesting people you ever meet. It could be your future best friend. It could be one of the most boring people you ever meet. You might not ever talk to them again, but you'll never know if you're staring at that stupid device. And that's what I feel like this whole, everyone, not just a whole generation, everyone moving forward It's all we do is look at that device in the grocery store line because it's a crutch. And I feel like we're losing this ability to just think, daydream, solve problems in our head, or have a little conversation with that person that could turn out to just be nothing, or it could just be a friendly little interaction, or it could just be, like I say, could be your future partner for life, or could be a friend. Like, I just feel like we're losing so much humanity because of these devices.
I totally agree with you. And when you try to explain that to a younger person, they go, yeah. And then they swipe. They go to the next point of interest. I think this grand promise of being more socially connected by being connected has been the opposite. I think being more connected has disconnected life.
I don't think that they really understand because they haven't seen the other side. Somehow they think having this device is what's, like you said, connecting them to people, but they don't understand that that's not actual connection. You know, that actual connection means laughing with someone and crying with someone and sharing secrets with someone and whatever, things that take time. It's not just liking the same photo or sending a photo of where you are at the time, or these things. Like our younger daughter said that she needed to have social media when she left eighth grade because her friends were all going to many different high schools. And therefore she needed to keep in touch with all these different people or make new friends or something. And I was like, that's not how you're going to keep in touch, is by all just sending a photo. I mean, I'll tell you how you can keep in touch is by getting together with them.
Right.
And you can text them. Yeah, definitely text them and call them and get together. Like, we will have get togethers at our house on Friday nights. And there are ways that you can keep those friendships alive. But this app where you send photos of where each other is, that's not going to keep your friendship alive.
That's right. Elizabeth, hey, take a look at what I'm eating. That's kind of what the world has become nowadays. And it's so interesting. Nowadays, when you and I were kids, if you want to talk to somebody, you pick up the phone and you call them. Nowadays, yes, you have to text somebody to ask them if it's okay to call them. It's like everything's out of whack.
And I don't know. You can tell I'm pretty fired up about this topic. And I'm definitely on the outs. I mean, my kids are... they're like the only ones who don't have social media, it seems like. So they tell me. It seems like everybody has it. And so it's this sliding slope, you know, and so kids are getting it younger and younger. And I don't know what it's going to portend. I mean, what is it going to be like for them as they grow up? Are people going to know how to interact? Are they going to know how to talk to each other? How are they going to meet people in their 20s? You know, do they know how to have casual conversation if they meet in a park or in a bar or at a party or whatever? Are they all just going to be staring at their phones?
I have a feeling the latter is probably more correct. And especially when parents in this day and age or this generation, they often will just hand a device over to the young child to act as a babysitter. So it takes a responsibility off of them because, well, first of all, they don't know how to communicate and have a conversation. They don't know how to teach. They don't understand that engagement is really what we're after. Those of us, I guess, over 40. I don't know what the world's going to be either. I feel kind of negative about the way when I look around, I see people who can't have a casual conversation and people who are unable to make any sort of comfortable eye contact and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's very important. I mean, one of the memories I have of my childhood is when my parents would have dinner parties. They liked to have dinner. I guess my mom got the confidence from the Julia Child cooking, and they would have these dinner parties, and we never had a child's table. We just had the dinner table. And so my sister and I got to sit at the table. We weren't like relegated to a separate room. And I always loved that. We just got to sit with the adults and we had conversations. It just always stuck with me. Like when we'd go to other people's houses and we'd have to go to this other room. And that made me, as I reflected back as an adult, I thought maybe that's part of what gave me the confidence to talk to people, is that I always felt like I had a voice. I could talk to people, everybody, of all sorts. My dad was a college professor and I could talk to people of different stripes. It didn't matter. And I wanted that for my kids too, to feel like they're not shy. I mean, you can be shy. It doesn't matter if you're shy or extroverted or whatever, but you have a voice and you are empowered to chat with people. And you, like you say, you make eye contact and you're polite and you can express yourself. It's very important in the world to be able to express yourself.
Are you finding that with the strong beliefs that you hold, that some of that has trickled down to your girls?
Yeah, they don't, there's no worries about them not expressing themselves.
Well, that's to mommy. What
My
about in
poor
real
husband.
life?
It's funny. I remember sort of a young age, my husband was like, yeah, we don't have to worry about these girls being too introverted or whatever. Yeah, I think there's certainly things we've still got issues and stuff, but they love talking to people. And on that score, it's fine. We're doing
Score for
fine.
mom and dad, then they picked up some of the good stuff.
They did. They're still, yes, on that, it's fine. They're lovely people. There's still one of them is still very annoyed about the social media, but one of them actually said recently, I'm really glad I don't have social media. I think it would waste way too much of my time if I had it.
Wow, that's almost unbelievable to hear that a young person would say that.
Yeah, she's very busy, you know, so I think she realizes that, you know, it can really suck you in. So
So let's switch gears. What documentaries have you seen lately that you really liked, or what television are you watching these days? What's pure entertainment for you when you break away?
well, we were a little slow, but my husband and I just finished Succession.
Oh, what'd you think?
We really liked it. I thought that was a really good show. Yeah, I was sad. I kind of didn't want to finish it because I just thought that was so well written.
It was, yeah.
And then the other show that I just loved, I can't wait for it to come back, is The Bear. Did you watch
Oh,
The Bear with
right.
cooking?
That's another great show.
The first episode, I was like, because people had told me, you like cooking, you have to watch The Bear. And the first episode, I was like, wait a minute, there's so much going on here. I don't know if I can get into this show. And we actually watched, we had the kids watch it with us, and they were like, nope, we're out. And so then just my husband and I continued to watch, and oh my gosh, I fell in love with that show. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
And it's coming back, I think. I just read for another season, so
Oh,
I think it,
great.
yeah. So, what else? How about you? Do you have a
Oh,
favorites?
wow. Barry was a great show.
Oh,
Did you get to
Barry.
look at that?
No, I haven't watched
Oh,
Barry.
my
Is that the one
gosh.
with Henry Winkler?
Yes. Henry Winkler
Yes.
and,
Yeah.
gosh, I can't think of his name.
The
It's
guy
S.
from SNL.
Right. Bill
Yeah.
Hader.
Okay. Yeah, I heard
If you
about it. I
can.
should.
If you can grab that's phenomenal. That's
Oh, great.
really great. Better Call Saul was a
Oh,
great
I love
show.
Better and Breaking Bad.
And Breaking
I
Bad,
love Breaking. Yeah.
right. And we just finished watching Ghosts UK.
Oh, I don't know that.
Oh,
Okay.
yeah. They have there's five seasons available. I don't know how you get your content, but they just finished their fifth season, Ghosts. It's the UK version, the BBC version, which is phenomenal,
Oh,
also.
great.
Great
Thank
writing.
you.
Yeah. There's some really great television nowadays, different than it was back when I was young, where if you were on TV and not in movies and film, you were considered less than. Nowadays,
That's
it's kind
right.
of flip-flopped. It's a different world nowadays. There's so much incredible content for television.
Isn't that true? And
Yeah.
actors and writers and producers are happy to work in TV because they can do these like 10 episodes or something and almost have it be like little mini movies. You know, they
Right,
get the
right.
support, they get the high production value.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, it's been great.
Another great show is Clarkson's Farm. Have you heard of that?
I feel like my husband has that on his list.
Okay,
I
Jeremy
you know.
Clarkson is a
Okay.
well-known UK celeb, and he's
Okay.
done a lot of television, and British celebrity buys a farm in the UK and then tries to make a go of it, and he documents it. It's just amazing. So
Oh,
that they have at
funny.
least two seasons that's already been produced. I think they'll be going to a third season. That's really good, entertaining stuff too.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we used to watch much more TV when our kids were younger because we put them to bed, and then if we weren't working or something, then we'd get a little time to watch TV and then we'd go to bed. And now they stay up later. And if they need help with homework or whatever, and we feel like we don't like Succession had a lot of language. I mean, that was
Oh,
not really
yeah.
kid friendly, even though they're not kids, but it wasn't really teenage friendly for our kids. And so we didn't really want to watch that around them. So it was just like, boy, that took us a long time to get through that. had to wait till they were busy doing homework or something. As a family, we just sort of watch. Oh, my kids love watching Survivor. You know, the old, it's like an old reality show. Well, it's not old. I guess it's still going on, but we just started.
After 20
like,
years.
It's 20 years. Yeah. Family friendly fair. But everyone's so busy right now. I feel like we don't have a lot of family nights right now.
It's so crazy that people are so busy. There's so much to help do our tasks for us. And yet people are busier than ever. They have less time than ever. They eat more fast food where they drive through. And people are just not doing the stuff that we used to and we kind of hold so near and dear now that we can look behind us and connect the dots.
That's the one. It is true. You know, everyone has 24 hours in a day and it's how are you going to spend it? And I do think there was this woman, a mom on my daughter's old basketball team. I remember she said to me, we're at this retreat thing and I was just making pancakes for the kids. And she said, you're making those? And I said, yeah. And she said, oh, from a box? And I said, no, I'm just making pancakes. And she said, I've never made pancakes. I've just gotten them from the freezer. I didn't even know pancakes come from the freezer.
Wow.
I mean, there's so few ingredients. She thought you couldn't even make them if they weren't from a freezer or maybe from a box. And she said that every night they order out. They yep. never cook. And it just made me realize like how differently people live. Like to me, a real priority is to cook. I guess we've talked about that. and you know, to use like real food. And to other people, that is a low priority. Like they just need to get food in the belly right. and the quickest way possible. And they must think that food and eating is just a waste of time. Like and it is the exact opposite for me. Like a family dinner is such a high priority for me. Like the only time that we don't have dinner all together is if one kid has like a basketball game that is late at night or, you know, 7:30 game. So the other three will eat and the last she'll have to come home and eat dinner. I mean, we will make every effort to have dinner together. And I know other kids like will come over to our house and they'll be like, oh, you have dinner as a family? Like they never have dinner as a family. And it's so interesting to me, these things that like my kids take for granted or the stuff that I make them for lunch. And they'll say, you won't believe what other kids have in their lunches. Mm-hmm. They'll be like a pack of chips, packaged juice, a package of that, like all these packaged things. And I'll right. be like, I mean, the environmental footprint on that for one thing, all these packages of things and all that, you know, and they're like, I'm so happy. Thank you for making me like now that they're old enough, they're actually grateful for the stuff that I just sometimes think it does take a long time. The stuff that I do takes a lot more time than just buying packages of stuff, but it's a value. I guess it's stuff I value.
Anyone like you and like me values the Zen that being in your kitchen brings. And it's way nicer than getting into your car and driving for 15 or 20 minutes mm-hmm. to a junk food, poison-filled fast food place to get your food and then drive back home and eat it, or just eating in your car. It's like, this is so crazy and foreign to me.
Yeah, that's such a good point. On on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, my mom and I always get together to cook together. And it's one of my favorite days of the whole year. And it's partly to have that time with my mom, but I sometimes start, you know, the Tuesday night and I get so excited. Like that time of just like the Tuesday night, you know, recently doing it and I just put music on and I was so happy. Like to know that I had that dedicated time where I was just going to cook and bake and I didn't have to do anything else because I had all this stuff I had to do. Like this was Thanksgiving and I couldn't work on my podcast or do anything else because I had to cook a lot. And I was so happy. Like this was kitchen time and it was made me so happy. I was like, I'm in my happy place here.
This is me time and everyone out and I'm yes. going to get down to business. I'm going to enjoy myself. This is where I thrive.
Yeah. And I guess I feel really lucky that I have that because obviously many people don't, which is why they get in the car and drive to the fast food place or the takeout place. And by the way, spend so much money. I mean, when people say like, oh, it's so expensive to buy, you know, fresh produce or whatever. I'm like, it's not nearly as expensive as to buy takeout every night.
That's right. And when you talk about the long-term, long-range health issues and implications. You could save a few bucks maybe in one direction, but then you'll pay on the back end, and that's just not good.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I guess some of it, I hope pays off. I don't, and people just have natural different interests. My husband doesn't like to cook at all, but so who knows what my kids will pick up on. But
so, you know, people who don't like to cook, I mean, they don't realize it, Elizabeth, but this is how the breakdown of civilization and cultures happen, is when people stop doing those things. Yeah, wars are awful and terrible, and all the other big stuff is awful and terrible, but it, at the lowest, smallest level, when people stop communicating and doing the things that are really high touch, this is how it breaks down.
Yeah, I can see that.
Okay,
I
remember, no more Debbie Downer stuff.
Let's get back to loving cooking.
Right. So what would be something that you might whip out at dinner time if you were going to make something special? What's one of your go-to favorites?
Well, the other night I made, during the pandemic, this recipe came out in the New York Times that is just so good. It's vegetarian. It was just written, I think it was a Melissa Clark or one of them. It's not even a recipe. She just wrote it like in an article. It's this like mujadara, but it's like lentils and rice and caramelized onions. And I always add like carrots and spinach in there. And it's, and there's a bunch of herbs. It's just so good and warming, like for the fall or the winter. Uh-huh. And I serve it like with naan. So you've got your protein and your veggies in there. I made that the other night. You know, it just takes like kind of an hour. It kind of cooks for a while. Yeah, it's kind of braised. I love making soups. I make a lot of soups in the winter. Salmon. I made a salmon bowl the other night that was kind of like a deconstructed sushi thing. You know, you had some so people could make what they want. I have been doing some different bowls recently, maybe with like Brussels sprouts and chicken and barley, or, you know, just some different things around so people can, that's kind of fun to, with a sauce. I like a sauce. I don't like anything too dry.
Same here. Do you buy whole spices, roast them, then grind them when you need them? Or are you not quite at that level? Or
I do sometimes. I'm at sort of a part and part. I do have a lot of already ground spices also.
Right. So I think when I ask those questions, a lot of people who are listening think to themselves that I have no life.
You definitely have a life. You just have a spice grinder and a life. Right. Or do you do mortar and pestle? How do you do it?
Spice grinder. I would use a mortar and pestle, but you know, it gets stuff everywhere, and that just creates more cleaning opportunities, which I really try to avoid if at all possible. So the spice grinder kind of contains everything.
So I'm curious, you being in Hawaii, does that affect the kinds of foods you cook? Because do you not do a lot of like hearty, you know, soups and warm kind of stuff because you're in a warmer climate?
When I'm cooking for people, other people like you, I'll cook something for you that I know that you'll love. Mm-hmm. When I'm cooking for me, it's, you know, back to the basics and simple stuff. And according to my regimen and my kind of dietary lifestyle now, which is way different after living an entire life of excess and then traveling with the rock and roll bands like the Eagles and Pink Floyd and Fleetwood Mac and cooking for all those people back in the day, it was an entirely crazy life when it came to the food intake and consumption. But now I'm cooking very, very simply. So a lot of seafood and a lot of eggs, a lot of avocado and that.
Oh yeah.
But when I'm cooking for you, you're going to get whatever it is you want.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
Do you find that when people have you over, they're intimidated, they don't want to cook for you?
I don't even get the invitations to go over to people's houses because they're intimidated to begin with. But the funny thing is that I never, ever critique friends and family. And you know why that is? Because I like having friends and family. When I was a food critic for Honolulu's largest paper here, I was very tough. I was known to be extremely tough on the restaurants because you're paying your good money. And, and I was here to protect you, the hard worker who's paying too much money for their food elsewhere. And so I was really tough. But when it comes to face with my friends and loved ones, anything I eat is going to be the best thing I ever tasted.
I just remember, particularly like after I went to cooking school and when I was at the Food Network and things, people just would not, same thing. They would say, I would love to have you over, but I don't want to have you over. I'm not going to cook for you or something. And I was so hurt. And I would say, honestly, I will eat buttered pasta. I will eat a salad. Like, it's not about the food. I'm not going to critique you. Like, just invite me over. I'll bring my own food. It doesn't matter. Like, don't judge me. I'm not going to judge you.
The thing that really pissed me off all throughout life, whenever I would have a potluck dinner party and I'd invite all my favorite people, I would be so surprised by the vast majority of the people who just went and picked something up instead of spent the time in their kitchen preparing something near and dear to them that they could bring over to Matt's house.
Oh, wow.
So after a while, you have to start giving people instructions. We're having a dinner party. It's a potluck. Make something. Don't pick up a sushi platter, you know, that kind of thing. And so that it even started, I guess, in the 90s, when maybe even before that, people picked up prepared foods. They just, people, there are two different kinds of people. Those of us who don't mind spending the time and actually enjoy it. And then people who just want convenience all the way, no matter what. Yeah. Everything's got to be easy.
Yeah. Yeah. They'd rather spend the money than spend the time.
Right. And I like to torture myself. I like to make things difficult. So, but I think that the end result is good. I think that people who sit down to break bread with me are really, really quite engaged by the food, the flavor, the color, the height, the architecture, the aroma, everything, you know?
Yeah, they appreciate it.
And they never realized it. They never realized it prior to that, because everything was drab and plain and beige, and that's the way that people grow up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can learn. You can educate yourself.
Yeah. All throughout my life, I had to always introduce my girlfriends and / wife to that room in the house where food gets prepared. They never knew it existed because it was always a matter of just going to the store to get their food or driving through because they're always starving. That was the word there. Like, people who say they're starving are not cooks. Mm. They're consumers. And there's a difference.
That's a good point. Yeah, I was shocked when I met my husband. He had in his freezer of his apartment, I think it was Stouffer's or Stouffer's, however you say it, frozen pesto pasta.
Wow.
And I thought, this is an abomination. You have frozen pasta? Like, what could be easier than to make pasta? Like,
and
come
you
on,
still
brother.
Married the guy.
It was awful. I started cooking for him. It was not hard to get to his heart.
Yeah. We can't express regrets about our loved ones at this point. We just have to kind of deal with it.
So needless to say, he does the dishes.
Oh, good. That's a good trade-off, actually.
Yes.
Tell us what's coming down the pike for your show. Who will you be having on? What kind of themes will we be working with?
Well, I have several options coming up. Just yesterday, I had an episode come out of a guy who deals with climate change, global warming with a humorous take. So he was really a fun guy to have on. Let me think. I haven't decided who I'm going to. I've done all of these interviews. I've kind of banked a bunch of interviews and I have to decide who I'm going to take, who I'm going to take on next. I have a woman who's bikini bodybuilder. So it's all the behind the scenes of a female bodybuilder.
Nice.
So that is something I didn't know anything about until I did that interview.
Did you ask her about the people who grease her up so everything shines? Did you? Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to hear that.
It is. I mean, it's the greasing up. There's the whole scrubbing down, greasing up, and there's a whole eating component too. Eating / starving yourself.
Right. That whole disorder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she gets into it.
Oh, I bet. You have to.
It was a whole year long thing for her to get to this.
Did you talk about the whole fake boobs thing and all that bikini bodybuilders have to do or do?
Oh, I don't think we did. I don't think she did that.
Because a real weightlifter / bodybuilder is not a bikini wearing person typically. And so there's just so much that goes into it. That's such an interesting topic. I can't wait to hear it.
I mean, it was fascinating because it's such a different world. I guess that's why it fit into what I'm fit in, even though something I'd never even thought about, because I thought this is a world I'm never going to step into. And yet people spend their lives at portions of their lives devoted to this thing. And there's so many there's so many pockets like that. And that's what I want my podcast to do, is just to kind of walk in these shoes for, you know, 45 minutes. Like, wow, there are people who are so passionate about this thing. And there is, it's interesting because she's, even though this is something I have no interest in doing, I can find commonality with this person. Right. You know, there's humanity in this person. She has issues that are kind of common to my issues, even though we're such different people. I just find that really fascinating at the end of the day, that even people who do things that are different or have achieved things that are different, we're all just people kind of finding our way on this earth.
Oh, this is so great. You know, anyone who's still listening now, we're already an hour plus into it. Oh. I want to go back to
the time podcast. Flies.
It really does. As far as the podcast goes, how do you find your guests to come on?
So, yeah, interestingly, I started off with kind of friends of friends. Some of them were college friends. Just, oh, wow, who can I find that fits this criteria? And then word kind of grew a little more. Some people would contact me. Oh, I heard this episode. Could I be a guest? And now oftentimes people contact me who I don't even know, or I'm on some of these, you know, podcast matchmaking sites where we can get together and somebody can hear about my podcast. Initially, it's funny. I think this is an important point for me to keep remembering and maybe can apply to anyone and no matter what they're doing. Sometimes you don't realize how far you've come unless you stop and look. Oh, a year ago or 2 years ago, this was my big worry. And this isn't my worry anymore. And I have to think of myself a year or so ago, year and a half, I was like, how am I ever going to get guests? Who am I going to book? Oh no, I'm behind on guests. Now I'm just sort of like, I've got a lot of guests. I mean, I've banked probably 8 or 10 episodes, and I've still got more interviews coming up, and that's wonderful. I'm happy to have this problem, but it's just not an active worry of mine right now. There's so many interesting people to interview. Right. So to answer your question, it's kind of people just, I'll get these emails. People are trying to get on the show, and many of them are not a fit. I mean, people want to be like I got this one recently. He sounds more like a life coach or something. He sounds like he'd be a perfectly good interview, but it just doesn't fit my criteria. It's not an interesting experience that most people wouldn't have. It just doesn't fit my show.
Right. You know, was he one of those 23-year-old life coaches who just became one after COVID and wants to tell me what to do with my money and my life?
I don't know, but there was another one I got recently. It was the third time, and his assistant or someone kept addressing me as like, dear Avaya or some name. And I finally just wrote back and said, there's no one named Avaya here. Like, it's not a fit for my show. And you've got to do your research. Like, you know, so I sometimes get these pitches and I almost don't even want to reply, but I feel like you got to be kind to people, but oy, 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 don't Have pitch me with the wrong name.
Oh, I know. So, is your show audio only, or do you do
I'm doing YouTube now. Okay. For a while I was putting the audio out on YouTube, and now we're putting the video out also.
Because you have people who are cooking or shopping or cleaning the house who want to listen. Then you have people who want to sit down and plop down on the couch and eat some popcorn and look at an audio or a video of an interview.
Yeah. They could also be cooking and watching too. Sometimes, you know, you've got your laptop on the counter and you can do both too. So
it's a great world. I'm so glad that you're able to join us today. How would people be able to watch and listen to you if they wanted to?
Oh, thank you. So the podcast is called What It's Like To, and we're everywhere you get your podcasts, you can find it. And we're on Instagram and Facebook and on socials, and then also on YouTube.
And are you doing all your media now at this point?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, you say that with a little bit of disappointment on your face.
It's a challenge, like I say.
Right. I do know that.
Not my specialty, but I'm trying.
Is there anything that you want to share with my audience before we say aloha for today? Something that it didn't ask you?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your curiosity. I love people who are curious about the world, and I relate to that. And so thanks for all your great questions. And I don't think so. I think we've covered a really wide range of topics. It's been very fun.
Good. I'm so glad you joined us today. I'm going to say aloha to you, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us.
Aloha.